goes nowhere.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 649. Jason Lindgren is with me, and the marquee fortune, De Saint Germain, returns, no longer using the moniker Count. He has the right to do so and has done so. We're going to cover the French Revolution. Fortune and I have talked about this many, many times, and many aspects differ from what I remember learning about it in school. But Fortune possesses his family's notes, diaries, just everything. So this should be an interesting, interesting episode. Welcome, Jason. And actually, Jason, this was your idea to go down this road with Fortune.
It was, and I'm very pleased and very appreciative that he was interested in taking this subject up.
I am too. So let's bring the man in. Welcome, Fortune. So glad to have you back.
And it is my greatest pleasure to come to all of you from the Golden Castle at the end of the world. Let's go, men. Help me out. Where the rainbow begins.
There it is. Do you have anything you'd like to mention before we jump in? We've got quite a bit of notes that you submitted to us, and we'll jump in. But is there anything you'd like to say before we do so?
All I have to say is, from the wilds of Wales, as far out from civilization as a person can get where I live now, we go back, my dear friends, to the halls of Morris High School, to my classroom, where I teach history and foreign language and English again. So here we go. Let's talk about the Saint Germains and who they were. We were a family that became barons and counts in the 1600s and eventually elevated to marquis, or in English, marquess, in the 1800s, during the restoration of the kings, the monarchy, from 1814 to 1848. We had generals, ambassadors, bankers, and we controlled the French India Company. During the revolution, the family grew richer and greater, as we had a bank, a general, a merchant business to supply the government. So there was General Count Claude Louis de Saint-Germain before the revolution. He died before. He was in retirement. And then there was General Count Antoine Louis de Cray de Saint-Germain. And our name is on the Arch de Triomphe because of him, who served Napoleon. But he was a soldier before the revolution and then worked for the Napoleonists. And we are the only family recognized by both regimes, meaning Count of France and Count of the Empire. Comte de France, meaning the king, and Comte de l'Empire, meaning Napoleon. After the revolution of 1848 and the birth of the Second Republic, comes the Second Empire and then the Third Republic. So as you see, France is like Italy. It became a comedy of short-lived governments, the English plot and the French riot. Now, the Saint-Germains lost their fame and their government associations with the coming of the republics. But even though we were no longer associated with government officially, we had many strategic marriages and many large dowries and many banking transactions and things that went on. So my great-grandfather, Maurice de Saint-Germain, my grandfather, whom I grew up with, Alexander de Saint-Germain. Now you speak to me, the Marquess of Saint-Germain, because I've taken the higher title of my grandfather. And there is my son, Robert de Saint-Germain. And there we go, my friends.
So you broke, let's see, it says here the Second Empire went from 1852 to 1870. Then the Third Republic began in 1870 and ran up till 1940. Was the break with the Saint-Germain family because the government fell, or what happened there?
Well, as the republics took hold, things became more democratic and people came into government that were no longer noble, and there was no longer a separate house like there is a House of Lords and a House of Commons in England. So those two chambers no longer existed in France. When the republics, the republic came in, the Chamber of Deputies did not include a higher chamber for the House of Lords like England and a lower chamber, the House of Commons. So as things went on, all of these old families and old titles had disappeared. But let me state now for everyone listening, Before the revolution, there were 17,000 noble families in France. After the revolution, there were only 3,000.
Was that by design or because bad things happened? Was there actually design behind that? And by the way, if the Third Republic runs 1870 to 1940, and you stated that there's no longer nobility in a lot of the governmental high offices, is that by design?
Sometimes things are by design. Some things they are by stupidity. And most of all, arrogance rules both. And if you have arrogance and stupidity in one package, it's most convenient for your enemies.
In this period of time, they're still recounting it. There's a new program on HBO about the powerful families in New York, but this would be the period of time being portrayed there when English nobility is trying to marry rich people in America because they can't afford to keep their estates up anymore.
And the French did that too, to some extent. So as the industrialists came in and the old world was fading, they tried to cling on to what they had by making strategic marriages to the dollar princesses, to the wealthy heiresses in the United States, particularly New York City, people like the Vanderbilts, the Astors, and the Jerome family. Leonard Jerome, who was the king of Wall Street, married his daughter off into the Churchill family. That was Winston Churchill's mother. Everyone is always looking for a good deal. Remember that.
So basically, you could almost state that with the fall of feudalism started the issue of these massive estates not being able to pay for what they possessed anymore. Is that correct?
Oh, the Renaissance had a great deal to do with it. Then the Age of Enlightenment, which we are in now, right now, the 1700s that led up to the French Revolution. And in England, the steady march and evolution of democracy.
So did the family start in France and then branch out to England?
My family was always in France, and we still are now, which leads me to lead in here about the most famous person in our family, the alchemist. Now, he was a member of our family. We said many broadcasts before, as far as I know, 1692 to 1812, that means he was 120, but there were sightings of him afterwards. He was a Christian mystic, in truth, an alchemist, and a breatharian. He had the power of foresight, the talent of foresight, and he also could read thoughts. He was a wisdom teacher of the violent ray. He knew herbology and homeopathy. He was a handsome and charming back-channel diplomat, entrusted with the most delicate missions as not to offend either side. And we shall return to the alchemist later, as we talk about the causes of the French Revolution. But let me give something here. No matter what the histories on the internet or books say, it's all conjecture. He was known at the court of Louis XIV. He was again seen at the court of Louis XV. He again reappeared, trying to talk to the king, Louis XVI, to warn of the danger. And in every successive time that he appeared, everyone remembered him from before. So just to lay to rest, he was from our family. He was the Count Saint Germain. And the kings did know him because he was a member of the family. He was recognized by all of the kings. And you're going to tell me that when he appeared, the kings did not know that he was not one of their aristocrats? They didn't ask the other members of the family, do you know this man? Of course he's a member of our family. So when he appeared under Louis XV, people had remembered him from being at court under Louis XIV. So his identity is not really under question. It's just only in later ages that people invent stories and conjecture and things. But as Napoleon said, history is an agreed upon set of lies. And Tolstoy said, history would be a great thing if only it were true.
So what Fortune just covered is a critical idea because of the internet, I'll be broad about it, the interest in the original Count de Saint-Germain. When I met Fortune and I had read books on the original Saint-Germain And I began to notice after I met Fortune, when I read a few more of them, that they're very legendary. And having spoken with Fortune about this, much of it is just legend. As an example, you're pointing out that the court knew darn well who he was, where in almost every one of those books I read, it's like, who's this handsome guy that showed up in our court? And the other thing is they spend a lot of effort trying to act like nobody knew where he came from and he might be German. So you want to dispel any of that?
I can't say what, Pete, you know, you're free to write anything you want. You're free to believe anything you want. And I guess that's how the jackals prey upon the innocent and the gullible. But as we go deeper into this, you will see who and what my ancestor truly was. And we will get a greater understanding of how much this man was a part of France and our family. So we go now into a little bit of history, background history, world history, that will help us understand the various aspects of life and the world, particularly the way of the world, and help us understand what we're living in today. The first thing we have to know for a long time on this, remember we said plane, planet means little plane. In this realm of ours, power perceived is power achieved. We go back to the wisdom of the Romans, and I'm not telling you this is right, and I do not agree with it, but the Romans knew bread and circuses. They were a socialist state. They knew to give the people bread and make sure they were never hungry and give them entertainment, just like today, because they knew that any country is 2 to 3 days away from a revolution if the food stops. So make sure the bread does not run out and the masses are entertained. And that equals no problems. The people will never, ever rise up. And what the French government forgot before the revolution is the same thing the Tsar of Russia forgot. They did not make sure the people were entertained appropriately, and they did not make sure the people were appropriately fed, because both revolutions basically broke out over bread riots. So the constant is, and I want you all to remember this, no matter where you are and what age we are working in, there is always sabotage in the ranks, whether it is a family, company, or government. There's always someone working against you. And for those of my good friends who always say this is theater, I give you a warning. Those who say history is theater are right. The world we are living in is a snuff film, so be very careful and watch your step, my friends.
That is a powerful statement, Fortune. We've talked here about this system. I've often referred to it as a death-based system. You want to add anything here, Jason?
I would suggest that concept is being very well looked after, at least in the United States, with things like EBT cards and such. They make sure that the masses have access to food at all times.
And the ultimate entertainment, your television and the internet. So in the brave new world, and in 1984, they both said the masses will never arise. The masses will never rise up because they will be too busy looking at the screen.
Well, to get back to the idea of this being a snuff film, this week a very interesting thing happened to me. We were notified some months ago that the smart meters were coming to this area, at which point I took the literature that had been handed out, I called, and I opted out. Along the way, I got notified that meters would be switched, so I called up and said, what the heck, I've opted out. And they said, oh, no, you haven't. And I said, yes, I have, so I did it again. I did this 3 times. 2 days ago, a truck pulls into my driveway with the Grid One logo, and there was a very nice young man there. And I said, you're not swapping my meter. I have opted out. And he said, well, it's not in my records. So at that point, I had the guy contact his local boss to put it on the record. We called for the 4th time to get all this put in. And I ensured that there was a database entry saying that I had opted out. But that's not the real story here. Over the past 4 days, everywhere I have driven in the state of Rhode Island and the outskirts of Massachusetts, there has been a fleet of Grid One trucks putting in the smart meters. And everyone is more than aware what happened in LA, and everyone is becoming aware that it might not be so healthy to live in a fog of these frequencies. But I just wanted to mention that, because if you live anywhere in this area, you're probably witnessing the absolute army of trucks swapping meters right now.
So what was the response that you got when you spoke to them and said that you had already done this four times?
Every time that I contacted them to inform them, including yesterday, is there was no record of it. And finally, one person yesterday, after I had the regional boss get contacted by the guy doing the work, who was very polite and very understanding, and then he made a suggestion, call another person. But the actual, I don't know, the operator that he calls during his workday admitted she found that I'd been opted out. But what it told me was that they don't care, because what's going on is they're doing this during the workday. So I'm guessing there's a lot of people not home, or could be. And if you're not home, your meter's going to get swapped. It's not like I got notified a day or two before saying, you know, the last notification I got was weeks ago informing me that they would be in the area sometime soon. So it looks to me like this is just happening. And if you don't remain on top of it, you might get delivery of a brand new meter.
Well, we're going back to feudalism, but this will be digital feudalism. So as I make this statement, let us go to the time before the revolution, the 1700s, which was called the Age of Reason, the Enlightenment. And the world was coming out of feudalism at that time. So the 1700s was an age of elegance. You saw the people with the white wigs and the powdered faces and the beautiful clothes. And this was the birth of the birth and rise of the real middle class. So we are in the age of ideas now, the age of elegance and excellence, when you saw grand salons in people's homes that patronized and gave a platform to the intellectuals. So you could have gone to some marquis or prince or duke's home and you would have met Voltaire, Rousseau. And in England, it was John Locke and Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, 1776, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon, 1776. And they were proud that they had cleaned up the world and the dirt of the past. And as we remember, 1776 is the birth of the United States, the American Revolution, which was based on ideas and not on blood and violence. So society and culture were on a great upswing. Things were getting much better during the reign of the last king, Louis XVI, because he was trying to make reforms. So many of us would have liked to have lived in that age, because it was a serious age and people were so proud of themselves and they knew that the world was on an upswing, unlike today where everyone knows that we are in the twilight or the fading of what we once had. But it's advisable to say to those out there who say, if you were rich, it was great in that time. Well, I have some bad news for all of us. It's great to be rich in any age, and it stinks to be poor in any age. Okay, now, we see in the late 1700s that London becomes the first metropolis since ancient Rome, approaching 1 million people in the late 1700s. But London was even greater than Rome because it had much, much more, and it had a middle-class merchant class. Now, here were the warnings, Jesuit plots everywhere, and the co-opted Masons. Countries that banned the Masons. Catholic Church and Islam to this day have banned the Masons. Tsarist Russia banned. Austro-Hungarian Empire banned. Fascist Spain, the Masons were banned. Germany, Italy, Japan, Soviet Russia, the Masons were banned. John Quincy Adams became president on the anti-Masonic party and was against their control and hostility to Christianity. The ban on the Masons by the Catholic Church exists, and it has been renewed until recently. So a Catholic cannot become a Mason, which is why the French felt no threat to the Masons, because it was understood that France, which was a Catholic country, you could not be a Mason and a Catholic at the same time. Let us proceed.
I wonder if in the modern era, you know, I was in the Marine Corps, so many of the people that I knew there, good people, got out and because of their blue collar job, end up being Masons. I wonder if they're aware of how many countries ousted them, because the list is extensive.
The Masons were co-opted by the Illuminati or the Illuminists, but there were two groups of Illuminists. One believed in Illuminism. They were not what you know as the Illuminati of today. They were self-realization and education by Illuminism. Those are not the people we are talking about. But the Bavarian Illuminati that co-opted the Masons was declared on the 1st of May, 1776. And that is where we get the socialist / communist May Day from.
Is there any connection to what you're talking about now to the reduction in noble families? You stated that before the revolution, there were 17,000 noble families, afterwards, only 3,000. And by the way, does that mean the families just disintegrated or were they literally gone?
Many were murdered. Others left the country and they never returned. They stayed where they were. It was a bloodbath, which we're going to very, very soon see what the French Revolution really was about and how whatever noble deeds might have begun at the beginning were quickly changed and co-opted. So we go to the causes of the revolution and what the factors were leading up to 1789. But first, we must understand that Louis XIII, who died in 1643, unified and earned the wealth of France. This is where we get the famous Cardinal Richelieu and the Three Musketeers. He was the rouge eminence, meaning the power that you see that is open. And then there is the eminence grise, the gray eminence, meaning a power behind the throne that you will never see or never know. So when Louis XIII dies, a five-year-old becomes king. That was Louis XIV. He died in 1714, but the Louis XIV we know as the Sun King was the bankrupter of France. He spent the money and bankrupted France by building Versailles and waging wars that he had lost. The quote that is attributed to him is, "I am the state, l'état c'est moi." So he built Versailles outside of Paris, 10 miles. He hated Paris and the rabble, so he built a government complex, his palace and Versailles, to stay away from the mob and the filth of Paris and the people he had disdained. So he was an absolute monarch. But this was a total government complex like the NAC in Egypt today. The Egyptian government is building a city just for the government and its workers outside of Cairo. So in case any public unrest goes on, the government complex is outside. And that's what Louis XIV built Versailles for. But you could not speak to Louis XIV. He was the supreme egoist, a malignant narcissist. And if there's anybody that was responsible for the French Revolution, it was Louis XIV. So, and he wanted all the nobles around him at Versailles where he could keep an eye on them so they could not be involved in plotting against him when they should have been on their estates in various areas of the country working with their tenantry, meaning the people that rented and farmed, the peasants. But we go now to something, the Battle of Blenheim, the War of the Spanish Succession, 1704 in August. When England won that war and defeated the French, it showed the English that it could meddle and succeed in the balance of power, so that from then on, no one country would be too strong on the continent to threaten England. As England never forgot the Norman invasion of 1066, the Battle of Hastings, where a French army crossed over the Channel and won. So at that time, the cry went up, a strong France is a dagger at the heart of England. And never again was there an invasion onto English soil that ever succeeded. So this was the paranoia of the English. We go to Louis the 15th, 1710 to 1774. I doubt whether he had any memory of his great-grandfather because he was five when he inherited the throne. He dug France in deeper with rampant spending and more lost wars. They were 7 years behind in paying their debts, but they would not stop spending. His famous quote was, "After me, the deluge. Après moi, le déluge." He was a very strong king, and the army was loyal. So if there were any uprisings, he would not have had any problem sending the troops into Paris and firing and bayoneting the people in the streets.
So when he says, "After me, the deluge," is he saying that I know this is all coming apart?
Of course. He said, "I am not afraid of the intellectuals and the people." And he said it with disgust in his voice. He said, "The regime will last my time." Now, for those of us who like the illustrious Count the Alchemist, he reappears in 1748 at the court of Louis XV. The Marquise de Pompadour, the king's paramour, and his mistress brought him over, where he was best friends with Frederick the Great, the emperor of Germany, of Prussia. So he had amused the king because the king was perpetually bored at Versailles and preferred his small apartments. And he knew that the aristocrats were hangers-on and basically titled them worthless. So he gave Saint-Germain a generous allowance to set up a laboratory where he had entertained the king on a daily basis. And our famous alchemist bestows miracles so that the aristocrats might listen. He removed a diamond, a flaw from the king's diamond, which is in our possession today, to show the king that he could do things. He talked about the future. And you cannot order a king. You have to merely invite and cajole and try to bring the king to listen. So as great a intellectual as the count was, he was trying to talk to the king and the people at court about what was coming and to try to convince them through pushing them in a slight way from behind and trying to lead them in front. But as we know, that did not succeed because there were too many powers at the court of Louis XV that were working against him, because there were too many people at the top that were making a great living at the old system, and they did not want to budge. So eventually, one of the ministers, the Duc de Choiseul, put out an arrest warrant for Count Saint-Germain, saying that he was a spy, but the count was too quick, and he had left knowing in advance what was going on. He shows up in 1780 trying to get an audience with Louis the 16th, for he knew what was going on and tried to warn the last king of the danger and what was going on against him. But at the same time, there was the same animosity at court. Don't upset the apple cart. Too many people at the top were making too much money. So when we come to Louis the 16th, his reign was 1774 to actually 1792. It was a short time. He was a weak personality and a weak ruler, but a very concerned man who tried to make reforms. He even abolished patricians' rights, where as a patrician, you could just say to somebody, "I want that person locked away," and he could disappear forever. So the last king was quiet and shy. He was afraid of the outside world. He rarely ventured outside of Versailles and its grounds. But had the king, like the Tsar, the last Tsar, not been so stubborn and given the people a constitution and the vote, the whole monster would have been defanged. all of the animosity would have gone, and then it would have been thrown into the people's laps to solve their own problems and gotten him off the hook. Just as Bismarck, when he was Chancellor of Prussia, introduced light socialism to defang the anarchists and take away their issue. So in somewhere between 1776 to 1781, the Count wanted an audience with Marie Antoinette to warn her of the Count of Maurepas and his influence at court and what was being planned. During this conversation, he not only told his confidence, the Countess d'Admirat, about what would happen in the next few years, but he also predicted things for decades to come. Saint Germain was able to see the deepest driving forces within the world movement. And in 1789, he clearly expressed to the Countess, as things were becoming undone, "He who sows the wind shall reap the whirlwind." What he showed her was that things had to happen as the great plan of the world intended, as the great intentions were. "What did I tell you, as well as the Queen, that Monsieur de Maurepas would ruin everything because he compromised everything? I was Cassandra, a prophet of misfortune. All is lost, Madame la Comtesse. This son is the last that will set on the monarchy. Tomorrow it will exist no longer. There will be another chaos, anarchy without parallel. You know how I have tried to give affairs a different turn. They have disdained me, and today it is too late. I came because I wanted to see the work which the demon Cagliostro prepared. It is infernal. Keep yourself apart. I will watch over you. Be prudent, and you will exist after the tempest has beaten down everything." That Countess did survive, and she did last out all the revolutions, Napoleon, and survived afterwards to write her memoirs.
For people who don't know, can you say a few words about who is Cagliostro? Because there are animes and stories that have made it into mainstream that, from my point of view, don't really paint the picture of who he actually is. Was he a good guy? Was he a bad guy? Tell us about him.
He was a dark wizard, a dark magician, someone who liked to see things burn, a jackal who could see where the weak links in the chain were, who could flatter people and present light forms of magic and convince them that they were miracles, a spellbinder.
Did the original Saint Germain and Cagliostro know each other?
Sure. They'd sat next to each other. One knew who the other was.
Did he serve any of the kings, or was he an independent figure?
It was an itinerant, wandering jackal. Wherever the wind took him and wherever what was best for him, he went.
Where was Count Saint Germain getting information from, knowing that the revolution was upon them?
Well, he warned in the 1840s and came back before because he knew that the last king was weak and was a shy, quiet man. But actually, that king was an intellectual, and he was very concerned about the people, so he did not want to use violence when the revolution broke out. His predecessors would have gladly used violence and mowed down the people in the streets. And that was the problem. Things were getting better because of the reforms, and that is why the revolution was able to break out, because the vice was being loosened, the thumb clamps on the people were being loosened. So I know that they did not understand that they were racing against time, because you see, when people are in power, they tend to ignore the signs of what may be coming against them. As I said, everyone on all levels, whether it's the lower class, middle class, or upper class, just wants the party to keep going in most ages. People usually do not want to change until they're threatened or it's too late. And to go and bring to what actually really happened here, a circular from the Masonic Lodges, 1789, Masonry, which prepared this revolution of 1789, is in duty bound to continue its work. The present state of opinion invites us to do so. From 1789, Freemasonry wished to found a new civilization radically opposed to the old order. It was necessary to overthrow that which constituted the strength of the latter, the monarchy and Catholicism. In 1904, in the Chamber of Deputies, the Marquis of Rochambeau pronounced the following words: "Masonry has worked in a hidden but constant manner to prepare the revolution." The following is from a report read in an assembly of the lodges at Nantes in 1883. It was from 1772 to 1789 that Masonry elaborated the great revolution, which was to change the face of the world. It was then that the Masons gave to the people the ideas which they had adopted from their lodges: liberté, éternité, fraternité, and égalité, which were lies. But those were the Masonic principles or ideals or slogans. But the Masons had bragged about it for the next 100 to 200 years, about how they had whipped up the rabble and actually created the real revolution. So this is all a matter of public record.
Well, the other thing was that the Count had foresight. When I've talked to you, even in the legendary things that I've read, it comes off like when he's speaking to the madam before that next day, that he's seen that this is all coming apart at the seams. Firsthand, he's seen it.
It's funny, you know, like the people who are all in power today. You see, the king was reluctant. He would have been he really did not want to be king, the last king, but it was foisted upon him because it was all according to blood and heredity. So he did the best he could, but he actually was a smart man and an intellectual. He didn't know who to trust or what to do. You are surrounded by sycophants all the time, just like Washington or London today. Everyone wants to be at the reins of power, and everyone thinks they know what they're going to do when they're there. And then once you get on the throne, you realize the throne isn't really a throne. It's a hot seat. It's the electric chair.
Jason, from like mainstream and school accounts, had you ever heard the degree to which Masonry played into the French Revolution?
Absolutely not.
Neither have I. Makes you wonder how much of that's going on now.
I don't recall Freemasonry being discussed at all in my schooling, even though that many of the founding fathers were very proud and open Freemasons.
As we've discussed, American education was co-opted since World War I. So after World War I, quite a bit had changed in the educational philosophy in the United States. So between the wars, quite a deal of the reworking of the curriculum had occurred. But you see, the people that were teaching by that time had been trained in 1890, 1900, 1910. So they had to wait till these people had all retired post-World War II, 50s, 60s, late 50s, 60s, and 70s. And that's when all of the rewriting and all of the redirecting of education came about.
Was there a connection between the Freemasonic lodges and what's generally called the Bavarian Illuminati?
The Bavarian Illuminati co-opted Masonry. They took it over.
1776.
My friends, we talk about all of these things. We've spoken before about there are no conspiracies. They're called deals. And whether the deal is made in the back room where no one knows about it or the front room, it's still a deal. So in every age, we said there's always sabotage in the ranks. Somebody is always trying to kick the chair out from under you and become the king of the hill. We know that from children and the old game, the king of the hill. So we talk about all of these things. There were many, many competing factors at the time. The two kings before Louis the 16th were very strong. So they had fear on their side. People were very, very loath to challenge them, and whatever was going on behind the scenes, these people were ruthless. The problem with the last king was he was not feared and he was not ruthless and refused to use violence.
And the aim was to start a new world order, for lack of a better term?
We have inherited the ideas, I guess, communism / radical socialism, were the Masonic principles, yes, to decapitate the church and the monarchy and bring about the new world order of world socialism, world communism, with a few at the top.
So this time period is where a lot of that can be traced back to then.
The French Revolution, there was never anything like it in 1800 years. So this is why it was so shocking to the rest of Europe and the old social order of church, king, and people, church, king, aristocracy, and then the serfs or the peasants. But we were moving out of that era. The 1700s was an illustrious, beautiful era of excellence in many, many things. Excellence in education, excellence in art, excellence in dress, excellence in manners. There's just so much to be said about that, which could be a second program. But my friends, we should move on and talk about the revolution and what it really did.
So, Fortune, we're coming up onto the top of hour one. I want to get into the revolution in hour two. And I don't think that's going to take the entire hour. I'd like to circle back and talk a little bit about your illustrious relative. But I wanted to ask, I've read so many things, and like Michael Hoffman's work and other things, where there's claims that the church was banning masonry, which we know, we can see the records everywhere, many countries did it. But then there's counterclaims that masonry infiltrated the Catholic Church. Do you think there's anything to that?
Today, yes, and many other religions.
And one of the reasons that I was reading about this is the idea of the power of the Jesuit order and the power of masonry, which is why I asked the question, do you think there's common purpose there now by the time we get to where we currently exist?
The Jesuits are the military wing of the church. Napoleon was totally against them. He kept screaming, the Jesuits are not a religious order. They are a military order. We will get into Napoleon and who and what Napoleon was and how the revolution gave birth to him. And there are just so many things to talk about, my dear friends, and so many parallels to what we are experiencing today. And we shall all discuss them in hour two.
All right. In hour two, we're going to pick up on the revolution itself. We're going to address a little more of the original Count Saint Germain, for the simple reason that there's so much interest and so many people go read the legendary works, which a lot of it's just legendary. Jason, is there anything you want to get in before I wrap hour one?
Well, since this is hour one and goes out to so many people, if you're hearing about all this for the first time or aren't that familiar with it, there's a lot of blatant nonsense around Count Saint Germain, the original Count Saint Germain. And a lot of people, especially grifters, will grift off of that name, trying to make themselves look like they're far more important than they actually are. And you really need to be looking out for that stuff.
It's a good point.
We will talk about when we reintroduce the second hour and we come in, you will tell your story once again, how you and I were connected and the famous advertisement on your show that brought us together. How's that?
Yeah, we can open up with that. And there's actually,
let's do that, because it's comedy and drama and truth all in the same thing.
Fortune, is your book still available? Do you want to give the title of your book and we'll provide links?
Please do again on the second half. I'll let you do that. And just to prove, my dear friends, that truth is stranger than fiction, you will listen to Young Crow's story of how we met when we return after these commercial messages.
All right, that brings hour one to a close. This has been hour one of episode 649 with Jason Lindgren and the Marquis Fortune de Saint Germain. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for access to basically everything. They get access to all the comments and to the forums. They can create top-level ideas to talk about. They can stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime they like. That has 10 awards in the world. It covers all the lunar waves, all the telescopic work I did on the moon, and the discovery of the so-called second sun in 2015. Also available on the website are the still images shot in hydrogen alpha of the sun. They're high resolution, and you can get them and print them. And if you do, please send us a picture. Lastly, You get exclusive access as a member to crow777radio.com of my current solar work. And there's not a lot of people doing this, and for good reason. The equipment is expensive and it's not easy to do. With that, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back in hour two, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.